scholarship and activism and speaking out on this issue. Thank you very much, Leah Keith.
So it's 3 o'clock in the morning for me. My brain is like, what are we doing here? All right, so this record came out in 1972, and that was also the year that my mother went to consciousness raising. True story. The glorious result appears before you. We have this record. I still know the words. And I remember going around the schoolyard and asking the girls one by one, are you for women's lib? That was what we said, women's lib. I was 7 years old, and I wanted to know who had my back. I wanted to know who was going to dig deep and find some courage and fight for women. I'm 51 now. I've lost every battle I've fought. But I'm still asking, are you for women's lib? For asking that question, for asserting that women are in class, I have had so many death threats that a phalanx of armed men was once assigned the job of keeping me safe. If you had told me 20 years ago that one day radical feminists would need armed protection to speak, I would not have believed you. And it's not the government that wants me dead. It's not the pimps and the pornographers. And it's not right-wing ideologues. It's entirely men on the left. And it's men specifically who call themselves transgender. All right, to explain all this crazy, I need to back up and start from some first principles. So, you know speed dating? I call this speed revolution. So, liberals believe that society is made up of individuals, and individualism is so sacrosanct that being identified as a member of a group is the harm. Okay, that's what oppression is. For radicals, society is made up of groups, and this was economic class in Marx's original version. But some of those groups have power over other groups. So being a member of a group is not an affront. Far from it. Identifying with that group is the first step towards political action. You make common cause with the people who share your condition. And the other big division is on the nature of social reality. So liberalism is what they call idealist. Social reality is made of attitudes and ideas, and social change happens through rational argument and education. Materialism, in contrast, means that society is organized by concrete systems of power. Not by thoughts and ideas, but by material institutions. And the solution to oppression is to take those systems apart, brick by brick. If you remove power from the equation, which is what liberalism does, oppression looks either natural or voluntary, which erases the fact that it's social subordination. So race, class, gender are seen as biological categories, as physically real, or even cosmically real. Right, that couldn't be any clearer. Race and gender are politically real, right? They're brutally, viciously real. But it's the ideology of the powerful that makes claims for some immutable origin. Now, this is a famous article, but there are piles of others, all desperate to prove that black people are naturally inferior. So they have charts, there are pictures. This is the propaganda of power. And in this article, Robert Bennett Beam also makes the argument that the same brain differences exist in women and in the lower classes. So it's all there. Black people, poor people, and women have stupid for brains. Okay, people get confused here. So there's sex, and then there's this thing called gender. Sex is a biological category. Male and female simply are. It's neutral, okay? It's just a fact. But gender, on the other hand, is a political creation. So as the UN says, it's the socially constructed roles, behaviors, activities appropriate for men and women. Naturalizing political categories makes them impossible to question. There's no point in challenging evolution or biology or God. So naturalism operates in the service of power. And so does voluntarism. Because if you're not going to go the biological route, the only explanation you have left is that it's voluntary. That for some reason, people willingly choose their subordination. But coming at this as a radical, Florence Kennedy wrote, there can be no really pervasive system of oppression without the consent of the oppressed. This does not mean that it's our fault. that the system will crumble if we withdraw consent, or that the oppressed are responsible for their oppression. All it means is that the powerful, capitalists, the racists, the male supremacists, can't stand over vast numbers of people 24 hours a day with guns. Luckily for them, and depressingly for the rest of us, they don't have to. People withstand oppression using three psychological methods: denial, accommodation, and consent. Anyone on the receiving end of domination learns early on to stay in line or risk the consequences. And those consequences only have to be applied once in a while to be effective. The traumatized psyche will then police itself. So, if they had but known they were slaves. There are entire bodies of discourse that ask the question of how the powerful get the oppressed to internalize the values of the oppressor. It's why the word hegemony was invented. But the take-home point: do not ever conflate consent with liberation. Consent is accommodation to unjust conditions that we do not control. Liberation is the complete overthrow of those conditions. This is radicalism in one elegant sentence. Oppression is a system of interrelated forces and barriers which reduce, immobilize, and mold people who belong to a certain group and affect their subordination to another group. Fry uses the image of a bird cage. One wire will not hold that bird. But oppression is like a cage. It's a system of interrelated forces. It's all wires working together. If you don't see that it's a system of interlocking barriers, well, the bird wants to be in that cage. It enjoys being in that cage. The bird is singing, eating, laying eggs. The bird is volunteering to be in the cage because it's the bird's nature to be in that cage. A distinct, substantive, immutable cage birdness, and it cannot be transcended. Okay, so feminism takes all of that and applies it to women. So patriarchy starts with human beings who are biologically male and creates a class of people called men. Men are made by socialization to masculinity. And that's the process that turns a child into a boy, into a man. Being a man requires psychology based on entitlement, emotional numbness, and a dichotomy of self and other. And their first despised other is, of course, girls. No insult is worse than some version of girl, usually female anatomy warped into hate speech. But once the psychological process is in place, that category female can easily be filled by any group that a hierarchical society needs dominated. Masculinity is essential to any militarized culture, because that's the psychology necessary in soldiers. One can only kill on command if the human impulse to care for one another has been subdued, and if that psychological process of othering is well entrenched. Now, central to masculinity is a violation imperative. Men become real men by breaking boundaries. For the entitled psyche, the only reason no exists is because it's a sexual thrill to force past it. The real brilliance of patriarchy is right here. It doesn't just naturalize oppression. It sexualizes acts of oppression. It eroticizes domination and subordination, and then institutionalizes them as masculinity and femininity. So it naturalizes, it eroticizes, and then it institutionalizes domination and submission. The brilliance of feminism is that we figured that out. As for femininity, that is just a set of behaviors that are ritualized submission. Female socialization is a process of psychologically constraining and breaking girls, otherwise known as grooming, to create a class of compliant victims. Across history, this breaking has included so-called beauty practices, like female genital mutilation and foot binding, as well as the ever-popular child sexual abuse. Femininity is just a traumatized psyche displaying acquiescence. This is not natural. It was not created by God. It's a corrupt and brutal arrangement of power. Now, contrary to popular belief, gender is not a binary. It's a hierarchy, global in its reach, sadistic in its practice, murderous in its conclusion, just like race, just like class. Gender demarcates the geopolitical boundaries of patriarchy. It divides us in half, but it's not a horizontal half. It's vertical. Gender is not some cosmic yin and yang. It's a fist and the flesh that bruises. It's a mouth crushed shut and a little girl who will never be the same. Gender is who gets to be human and who gets to be hurt. This has to be made clear because men know what they are capable of. They know. They know the sadism they built into their own arousal. Do it to her, is what they say to each other. Not to me, the human being, but to her, the object, the thing. And her has to be obvious, both visually and ideologically. See, there she is, unable to walk. There she is, on display, or there she is, secluded and covered, for your eyes only. And how much easier if you can say, God made her this way, a lie beneath me. Or nature made her this way, an empty hole. Or even, her brain made her this way, the slut who asks for it, because she always asks for it. The rape, the poverty, the prostitution, even the murder, she asks for it. Without feminism, the realities of women's lives are unspeakable. Each woman cut adrift in a hostile, chaotic sea. Apply the word sex class, and that chaos snaps into a sharp pattern of subordination, from the small daily insults to body and soul, to the shattering traumas of incest and rape. The crimes men commit against women aren't done to women as random individuals. They're done because women belong to a subordinate class, and they're done to keep women in a subordinate class. This is the exact moment a radical is born. There's a group of people called men, and they have power over a group of people called women. It's not individual, and it's not random. It's political, and it's unjust. Those unjust conditions are what Andrea Dworkin named the barricade of sexual terrorism. That barricade defines the parameters of gender. It's really simple. Women are inside it, and men are outside it. And actually, men are building it, fist by fist and fuck by fuck. And it's exactly those violent, violating practices that create people called women. That's what men do to break us and keep us broken. And that's what gender is, the breaking and the broken. We will never get justice for women until we dismantle the caste system called gender. So that eroticization of power, that barricade of sexual terrorism, brick by brick, we have to bring it down. Not accommodate to it, not make the best choice we can inside it, but bring it down. And now we come to the newest brick in that barricade, transgenderism. I have spent an ungodly amount of time reading the words of teenage girls who think they are trans. It has broken my heart in ways that will never be healed. In their own words, this is what makes them transgender. I like skateboarding. I like math. I want short hair. I don't want to shave my legs. I hate my body. They want physical freedom, a life of intellectual pursuits, and bodily integrity. They want to be human beings, not objects. Feminism is very simple. It claims all women are human beings, not objects. Feminism is also very hard, because in the words of Andrea Dworkin, it requires precisely what patriarchy destroys in women, unimpeachable bravery in confronting male power. Transgenderism is also very simple. It claims some people like being objects, and those people are called women. Other people don't like being objects, and they are called men. This is innate, immutable, caused by God, or hormones, or gray matter, or white matter, or the interstitial nucleus of the anterior hypothalamus. Whatever the cause, it certainly isn't a brutal arrangement of power, and it can't be called male supremacy, and there aren't any agents, and if they were, they wouldn't be called men. No, women's little brains can't handle the rigors of skateboarding or math. Instead, we are compelled by God or hormones or the interstitial nucleus of the anterior hypothalamus to be petty, precious princesses. And when we age out of that, the pornographers are waiting. The number one internet search term, teen porn. 14-year-old girls are not stupid. The only world they see is a cage made by men and their predations. The only feminism they see is a celebration of collusion, not any kind of resistance. The personal isn't political now, the personal is personal. And some girls just happen to hate their bodies because they are really boys. Never mind when essentially all girls hate their bodies. You cannot see yourself in other girls. You cannot name the caste you all inhabit or the system that puts you there. Any route to sisterhood, any rumor of female solidarity, any last whisper that once there were women who were warriors is gone. It may amaze you to learn that in 1970, 90% of women said they were satisfied with their bodies. By 1980, that same 90% were now dissatisfied. Let that sink in. In one decade, women's self-loathing exploded from almost none to almost all. What happened? Well, here's the start of 1970. That is today, women face both daily and lifelong insults to our intelligence, our bodies, our integrity. But in 1970, sexual harassment wasn't a legal concept. The words domestic and violence hadn't been put together yet. The reality of women's lives was almost unspeakable. The women who built the most recent sisterhood, the second wave, are constantly derided across the culture. But here is a short catalog of their projects. Rape crisis hotlines, battered women's shelters, abortion and birth control on demand, sexual harassment laws, funding for girls' sports, and the storming of the barricades in the trades and professions. Sisterhood is powerful. What else happened across the decade? Well, the seismic shift begins from print-based culture to an image-based culture. I don't know if it's possible to overstate the damage this has done to our brains and our humanity. The age of the image is here, and the image of the age is the female body, objectified, stripped, bruised, starved, and even dead. The backlash to feminism is bound to come, only now the boys have a whole new arsenal with which to punish us, hard, fast, and publicly. In 1972, Deep Throat is the first porn movie to go mainstream, and it doesn't take long. Little girls start turning up in hospital emergency rooms with gonorrhea in their throats. 5 years later, 1977, Snuff arrives in movie theaters. It only took 5 years to go from Deep Throat to Snuff. Men lined up at 5 a.m. to see this film. And here we are, 32 million hits for torture porn. Their hunger for this is bottomless. And I'm shocked, I tell you shocked, that millennial men are less egalitarian and more misogynist than older men. Pop culture is now porn culture, and pornography is available on every cell phone at the touch of a button. In my lifetime, men have created an entire regime of degrading and dangerous sex acts enacted without remorse or on the bodies of girls and women everywhere. I was born in 1964. The 70s were my formative years. In my age group, we hated our bodies, and we punished them with eating disorders and self-harm. And yeah, those practices spread like wild social contagion, and nothing has changed except for the worse. These practices have now been medicalized and institutionalized. Your doctor will take care of that horrifying female fat with chemical injections, and your surgeon will do the cutting for you. And the federal government will pay for it. I've also spent a fair amount of time with these fine gentlemen. This is what they think a woman is. And how many of these photos do we have to see before we see the pattern? Does it get clearer when you see them dressed as sexy schoolgirls? There are over 20 million Google hits for this. You could also ask the women and children who have survived these men. Their stories are horribly the same. Used by narcissistic, abusive men who demand full servicing of their sexual fetishes. These women are cast aside and condemned to silence, because their experience gives lie to the transgender narrative of the brave, suffering hero struggling to be free in a cruel world. Well, yeah, the world is cruel, but it's cruel because of overwhelmingly male sadism, a sadism well-organized and eroticized against women. A sadism these men share with their brothers. You don't believe me? You don't have to. Go on the internet and make any statement that contradicts the Church of Transgender. Here, I'll give you one. The penis is a male organ. Straightforward. It's not hate speech. A basic biological observation. The penis is a male organ. Go ahead and try it. And prepare for your life to be destroyed. Okay, to bring this to a close. We say biology is real, that humans are a sexually dimorphic species. This doesn't seem controversial, but the transgenderists have made it so. note the scare quotes around biologic sex. They insist that biology is a social construct. So I guess we're all here because our parents fell for the evil cisgender overlords who insist on the fantasy of sperm egg. As for gender, we say it's oppression. They say it's all good. The only problem is we don't get to choose between the dominant and the subordinate role. Because some men get off on being sexually submissive, they are enraged when they are denied their fix. Our solution is to dismantle male power. Their solution runs into a B problem. Okay, so we say gender is a social construct, therefore dismantle it. Anything humans do, they can undo. But their claim is that biology is a social construct. If that's the problem, the solution would be to dismantle it. But they know deep in their hearts that biology is not a story humans tell each other. They can't dismantle it. That's like saying dismantle gravity. So the best they can do is disallow anyone from referencing it. And this is what is happening, not just across the internet, but on college campuses. Women can no longer talk about menstruation, abortion, pregnancy. In fact, we can't even use words like vagina or celebrate our vulvas without invoking the wrath of the transgenderists. Because these men know that biology is real. And so their only option is to stop the rest of us from talking about it. And they are succeeding. Our best outcome would be women's liberation. Their best outcome? Well, to date, women are losing the ability to talk about sex-based oppression, since apparently sex doesn't exist. So our self-hatred is internalized and personalized. The human body is further commodified, and even from an anti-capitalist perspective, this should be horrifying to anyone who cares about human dignity and human rights. E. de Boer wrote presciently of the society of the spectacle, where being becomes having, and having is reduced to merely appearing. Now, instead of inhabiting the soft animal of your body, as poet Mary Oliver says so sweetly, the body is an object to own, and then to starve or slice until it approximates that punishing, promising image. Our genitals are now a commodity to be attained, rather than tissue to inhabit. The exquisite nerve endings, where animal meets angel, severed to create a surgical simulacrum. There is nothing wrong with the animals we are. Especially, there is nothing wrong with anyone's genitals. And from this, I will not wish. Genderists want to liberate our men's sexual fantasies. And for that, they need women's subordination. I'm asking the same question now that I did as a child. Are you for women's liberation?
Yes!
I still want to know who has my back. I want to know who is going to find that unimpeachable bravery and confront male power. Because men have way up to their game. As the pornographers conquer the culture and the world, as that cage of dead gender locks down ever tighter, most women are submitting in frozen silence. We're going to have to match their contempt with our courage. We're going to have to match their brute power with our fierce and fragile dreams. We're going to have to match their endless sadism with a determination that will not bend and will not break and will not stop. And if we can't do it for ourselves, we've got to do it for her. Five words to live by. Thank you. Thank you so much, Alina. We need to catch up on a little bit of time, so I'm just going to keep this session to 5 minutes. I think we've probably got time for two questions or points. And then we'll go straight to the next presentation. So put your hands up really clear so that I can see.
I was just going to say it's really important to make historical comparisons because, you know, looking at the way the brain has been analysed, you know, for the last centuries in the favour of people in power is really important. And I was going to ask you, have you made an analogy with the witch hunting craze? Because during that time, a lot of children were pathologised and a lot of them were brainwashed into thinking they had been possessed. And again, it was this powerful cult that was indoctrinating children you know, to think and feel a certain way. And I do think there is a comparison to the indoctrination that's happening now, where we're pathologizing childhood, you know, for the benefit of a dominating group. And also, during the witch hunting period, it was a money-making industry.
Sure.
So you could compare it to the, you know, the profits that the pharmaceutical industry is making now, you know, from transgenderism. The church made an enormous amount of money, you know, from the Inquisition. So I just wondered if you had some response
to that. That's a great point. And I mean, all that witch hunting, you know, always is a social contagion. So, I mean, just even on that level, we're looking at a very similar phenomenon. And certainly those of us who have been deplatformed and threatened over and over again, we feel like it's a witch hunt. I mean, my career is basically over. I can't ever speak at universities. Even if I get an invitation, within 2 weeks it's rescinded. And this is true for everybody I know. Like, if you poke your head up the tiniest bit, it's just over. You know, and they'll forget who your friends are, and then they go after your friends. So it really has that feel. And, I mean, none of us have been killed, but there's definitely so much fear among women to say anything publicly. They're terrified. They're terrified for their jobs. They're terrified for their kids. And it's scary. There's no way around it. It's really frightening. So, I mean, I tend to compare it to McCarthyism more. You know, this is lockdown and public debate, and, you know, you have to follow this certain line. And I think you've got a very good point.
The Labour Party this week.
What's that?
The Labour Party this week.
Right. Yeah, okay.
Okay. Who was the first person that I attended? No, there was someone before.
Okay, we'll go to you then. I'm sorry, you interrupted this. I just want to say there's more now. Okay, just make it brief.
Okay. So I find a lot of my energy going towards trying to heal from body hate. What structures, what daily practices, how do you help someone heal? What do we need to do together to help heal body hatred?
So I think there's two levels. The first is that personal level, you know, your relationship with your own body. But I think the more important level, honestly, sometimes is social. And I, in 1980, as a teenager, I was 16, I mean, I found a radical feminist, lesbian feminist community where we said every woman's body is sacred and we meant it. And there was such tremendous social power in knowing that I was not alone, that there was an entire community of people who were going to hold to that as a principle, and really as a sacred principle. And that just made such a huge difference for so many of us. And we don't really have that anymore. You know, the pornographers have so won that the lockdown now on girls is so much worse than anything that I could have imagined. You know, like what's happening out there. We were just talking about this last night, but there's these just horrible practices. I mean, now they're all having labiaplasties. They're having their labia sliced off, you know, permanent genital mutilation, because they feel their bodies are so unclean and disgusting. This is absolutely about pornography. So we have to fight it on a social level, and we have to try to recreate those communities again where the female body is accepted. And even on the left, this was a thing in the 60s and the 70s, where the natural was something that was upheld as a value. And that meant loving your body. It started with there's nothing wrong with our bodies the way they are. And nobody put their hair out, and nobody was shaving, and that was like the hippie thing. But there was at least a subculture where that was and understood to be of good value. And that's just been utterly destroyed as well. You know, and I mean, you all gave me this great, you know, round of applause when I said that I'm not backing down from the animal and our sexual organs, but that's a controversial statement at this point. I mean, people really think their bodies are commodities. And that, we've got to break that. So this is like on a huge social level. And then you've got the sort of personal, well, what do I do now? I hate myself. Like, how do I personally deal with this? I would say cognitive behavioral therapy is actually really helpful, or any kind of meditation practice. You know, when you just sit with it, essentially, it's like, well, I'm having these feelings, but they don't have to, like, overtake me. So, you know, you make those behavioral kind of boundaries, like, all right, even if I feel this way, I'm not going to start myself. Even if I feel this way, I'm not going to binge. You know, if I feel this way, I'm at least not going to say it out loud, you know. And I know women who, I mean, one thing that really worked for them was just standing in front of a mirror 5 times a day and saying, I love you, body. You're my life. You're why I'm alive. And just to reinforce that message every day against all the other crap that comes at us. And we see, what, like 4,000 images of naked women every day or something in the media? It's like insane. Who can stand up to that personally? We can't as individuals. That's why it's got to be social. But I do think that this feeling is possible, you know, for us as individuals. So thank you for that question.
Okay. Now, I want to say a huge thank you to Liette.